The headlines. The leader of Afghanistan's National Resistance Front, Ahmad Massoud, calls for a national uprising against the Taliban. Iran strongly condemns the military offensive against Afghanistan's Panjshir Valley, saying the news coming from the valley is very disturbing. And the Ghanaian Special Forces pledged to set up a unity government to oversee a transition period, one day after they staged a coup in the West African country. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is news. The leader of the anti-Taliban forces in Afghanistan's Panjshir Valley calls for a national uprising against the group. The leader of the National Resistance Front said that his forces are present in strategic areas of the valley, vowing to continue the battle against the Taliban and their partners. Ahmad Massoud accused the U.S. and NATO of indirectly arming the Taliban, Daesh, and Al-Qaeda. He slammed the Taliban for violating human rights and targeting the women and children of Panjshir. Massoud also called on the international community to take action against what he called a horrifying tragedy against humanity in Afghanistan. Earlier, the Taliban claimed control over the entire Panjshir Valley. The group said that a new Afghan government would be announced soon, without elaborating. Earlier, our Kabul correspondent Amin Alami joined us with an update regarding the Taliban claim about the takeover of Panjshir.
According to Taliban spokesman Zabihullah Mujahid, the war in Afghanistan is over because the Taliban are now in full control of the entire country after the collapse of Panjshir into the hands of Taliban. However, despite the Taliban are claiming that we have full control over Panjshir, Mujahid says that an amnesty has already been granted to those who were inside Panjshir and were fighting against the Taliban there. He particularly named the leaders of Resistance Front and Panjshir as those who will be benefited from this amnesty, and called on them, not only on them, but on all those former government officials who have fled the country to return back to Afghanistan. Mujahid insisted that the war is over in Afghanistan. That is why he called on all the people of Afghanistan and political players inside and abroad to come together and reconstruct their own homeland.
Iran's foreign ministry says any type of foreign interference in Afghanistan will result in a defeat.
The foreign interference that you referred to should be investigated. We are investigating it. We condemn all foreign interference. Everyone should know that Afghanistan's history has shown that foreign interference, be it direct or indirect, has always resulted in the failure of the aggressor.
Saeed Khatibzadeh said the people of Afghanistan would always fight for their independence. He also strongly condemned the military offensive against Panjshir Valley, saying that the news coming from the region is very disturbing. Khatibzadeh stressed that Tehran will try its best to contribute to the establishment of sustainable peace and the formation of a broad-based government in Afghanistan. He called for dialogue among all Afghan factions to resolve differences. Weeks after the Taliban takeover of Afghanistan, hundreds of Afghans who have arrived in India are demanding refugee status in the world's largest democracy. As Munawwar Zaman reports, these refugees are worried about their future, especially the children, amid calls for concrete refugee policy in India.
As the world battles extraordinary refugee crisis for decades, hundreds of Afghans who have arrived in India after the Taliban take over of their country, they have been protesting outside the UN refugee office in New Delhi, demanding refugee status, justice, and protection for their women and children. Experts say India is not a signatory to the 1951 UN Refugee Convention or the 1967 protocols relating to the status of refugees. Therefore, it would be a challenging task to deal with another refugee influx. In India, where internal migration has been one of the most challenging tasks for the country due to huge population and possible mismanagement of the refugee policies. Observers say another refugee exodus could be a hard job for the country, considering its complex bureaucratic registration process. They say the country needs a uniform refugee policy. As India has no specific program for refugees, it allows the UNHCR to operate a program for them. Based on reports, thousands of Afghans are registered with the UN Refugee Agency, but there are many who are still demanding the refugee status despite arriving in India a decade ago. Experts say now the new influx might compel India to rethink its refugee policy.
Like many other nations and countries, India is home to a large group of and large chunk of refugees who come from their countries of origin to seek protection. But the confusion arises when we come to the mechanism, how India governs its refugees. In India, they have not a sound mechanism which can deal and which can protect these minorities.
A decade ago, scores of Afghan refugees arrived in India, leaving their war-torn country, but they still have trouble in accessing basic services like education, healthcare, and employment. Many are now demanding financial assistance due to lack of income. Others say they would return to their country, but are skeptical and still reeling from the violent past.
I think we have no future as the whole world is silent on our plight. The memories of violence still haunts us. I have a refugee card, but it does not help me as it should as a refugee. I urge the UN and the international community to pay urgent attention to us. We are worried for our future as our fate remains uncertain.
Despite India's rich history of ties with Afghanistan and home to hundreds of thousands of refugees from across the globe, the country has no clear-cut policy for refugees or any domestic law. Experts say by framing a concrete refugee law, India would be able to appropriately protect the rights of refugees. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
There's speculation that the Taliban's takeover of Afghanistan after a long and costly U.S.-led war has prompted some British war veterans to commit suicide. British officials say that they are investigating the case. Earlier in our news review program, we discussed the issue with our guest.
It's news review time. Do stick around. Now, Britain's Armed Forces Minister says the country is investigating whether or not the chaotic withdrawal of U.S.-led forces from Afghanistan led some war veterans to commit suicide. Now, that statement followed comments by Junior Defense Minister that some soldiers had taken their own lives in the past week. James Hapi initially cited bad feelings among the soldiers over the situation in Afghanistan, but he later wrote back from the commitment saying it had been incorrect. Britain lost 457 armed forces personnel since joining the U.S.-led coalition that invaded Afghanistan under the so-called War on Terror in 2001. The Taliban's takeover of the country after the longest and costliest U.S.-led war dismayed coalition's troops. However, the U.K. Defense Minister says it has no confirmed suicide cases among British Afghan veterans due to the withdrawal. Now let's talk about this and get some insight. Joining me will be a couple of guests. We'll have our own Robert Carter, a correspondent in London, and John Stippling, author and commentator, is also joining us from Indre, Norway. Good to see you both. Robert, what's the story? Tell us some more about it and how the feeling has been. I mean, Mr. Biden never told U.S. allies what he was planning to do, and then he, as he put it, squarely stood behind his decision. It should have left some bitter taste in the mouth of U.S. allies, including the U.K.
Yes, it definitely has. I think what the biggest story is raising at the moment in the U.K. is there is a narrative that ultimately has British veterans, British military personnel, was their time in Afghanistan a waste of time, and did many of the British soldiers that were killed in that occupation, did they die in vain? So obviously, we have our own views of that, particularly those in Afghanistan will have their own views on it. But in the UK, they obviously see it from a British perspective, rightly or wrongly. And that's the debate which has taken over here in the UK. And there are many pundits, many journalists, many critics of the government who have also been attacking US President Joe Biden on this very issue, because once again, the UK has been left in a situation where they have to follow US diktats on foreign policy. So it was debated, for example, that the UK should potentially stay on longer to obviously continue to evacuate people from Afghanistan, even when the US has pulled out of Kabul airport. But that, of course, became apparent that that couldn't be the case because the UK was incapable of staying on past the US's withdrawal and the Taliban set deadline for occupation forces to pull out. So again, it was a major embarrassment for the UK, and it was very poorly received by the British, by elements of the British public, including media circles. So ultimately, that's what we're seeing playing out now, and this absolute confusion surrounding these veterans apparently committing suicide, allegedly, over the situation that's been unfolding in Afghanistan over the past few weeks. That, of course, has only added fuel to this debate, which is going to continue raging, but likely will be right-wing elements who have a bitter taste in the mouth at how badly and embarrassingly British military prowess has been defeated in Afghanistan by the natives. So that debate will play out, and a lot of it is interestingly being targeted at Joe Biden as well, you're absolutely right, but also the British government is coming under heat as well, and in particular, it's Afghan refugees which are also going to be the targets of this debate, because now, with the British feeling so sore about this, British right-wing pundits are going to advocate for taking in basically no Afghan refugees as a kind of revenge, if you like, for their failures in Afghanistan itself.
Right. Can I love to turn to Norway, to John. John, how would you feel if you were a soldier having to fight elsewhere, you know, miles away from your country, and maybe you don't know what you were fighting for, what you were giving your life for, and then even if they don't commit suicides, they have this post-trauma disorders and all that. And we just had news out from the U.S., a former Marine killing some children and women.
Well, you know, the suicide story that was originally broken was a curious story to begin with, because the implication was somehow that the soldiers were committing suicide because the withdrawal from this illegal occupation in Afghanistan, which simply was a risible narrative, but the story of military suicide is really pertinent. In both the U.S. and U.K., I have more knowledge of the U.S. statistics, but there was a huge uptick in suicide in the military prior to the pandemic. It has only been made worse through the pandemic because significant numbers of veterans are homeless. 33% of men homeless in the United States are military veterans. That's a staggering figure. Many of them suffer, PTSD, as you mentioned, other problems adjusting to life back in civilian society, and so forth. And they're not really ever taken care of very well by the U.S. government. The Veterans Administration does a few things, and there are some voluntary organizations that help. But it's a shameful condition for veterans right now. And has been for a few decades, since Vietnam, really.
Thank you very much. Robert Carter joined me from London, and John Stubbling, author and commentator from Indre, Norway. And that's it for this edition of the News Review.
Canadian Special Forces pledge to set up a unity government to oversee a transition period one day after they cease power in the West African country. Head of the country's elite Special Forces group, Lieutenant Colonel Mamadi Doumbouya, promised that there would be no witch hunt against the former government. The Canadian coup leader, however, said that all government officials are barred from leaving the country until further notice. The elite army unit has reopened the country's land and air borders for commercial and humanitarian reasons after it shut all borders and dissolved the government on Sunday. The Army says government mismanagement, poverty, and widespread corruption have prompted the coup. The international community has condemned the military coup and called for immediate release of President Alpha Conde. Iran says the resumption of talks over the revival of the 2015 nuclear deal will not happen as long as, quote, Western pressure on Iran is there. The Vienna negotiations have faced a long break following the election of the new Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi. Yusuf Jalali reports.
Talks over the revival of the 2015 nuclear deal have faced a three-month hiatus following Iranian elections in June that brought Ebrahim Raisi to power. The European parties to the multilateral accord are now urging Iran to come back to negotiations. The new Iranian president, Ebrahim Raisi, says resuming the talks is on his agenda, but that they should not be held under Western pressure, and the U.S. must first lift all its sanctions against Iran.
We'll never run away from negotiations, but what the Westerners are trying to do, what Americans are trying to do, what they're pursuing is that they want to apply pressure. I mean, you could even have talks and dialogue, but at the same time, if you have pressure, well, what kind of negotiations are they? I mean, we need to have negotiations without pressure. That's not negotiation with pressure. So the threats that they're making against our people, these brutal sanctions, economic sanctions that they have imposed, this is not the issue of negotiations that we're talking about.
Six rounds of talks on restoring the deal have so far been held in Austria's capital, Vienna, since April. The discussions are aimed at bringing the U.S. and Iran back to full compliance after Washington unilaterally abandoned the deal, and Tehran retaliated by scaling back its own commitments. The U.S. seeks a broader deal that would include Iran's missile program, but Tehran doesn't buy any such notion as negotiation for the sake of negotiation, says Iran's foreign ministry spokesman in his weekly briefing.
The Vienna talks are aimed at ensuring Iran's rights under the nuclear deal, which were violated by the U.S. lack of commitment and Europe's inaction toward the deal. So we are not negotiating a new deal.
Under the deal signed in 2015 between Iran and the six world powers, Tehran agreed to curb its nuclear activities in exchange for sanctions relief. In 2018, ex-U.S. President Donald Trump withdrew his country from the deal and reinstated sanctions on Iran. Tehran, in return, moved away from some of its obligations and resumed uranium enrichment to 20% purity. In the Vienna talks, Tehran vowed to reverse all of its retaliatory steps on the condition that Washington removes all its anti-Iran sanctions. The new Iranian administration has not given any specific date as to when it will return to the Vienna talks. But what's clear is that the fate of the nuclear deal is equally important for Raisi as it was for the previous government, except it's not the first priority for the new Iranian president, as he doubts the U.S.'s sincerity in lifting the sanctions after six rounds of fruitless talks. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Israeli police say that six Palestinians have escaped from a high-security prison in northeast of Al-Quds. Israeli media say that the prisoners were cellmates and had tunneled out of Gilboa prison overnight. The reports say that five of the prisoners belonged to the Islamic Jihad movement, and one was a former commander affiliated with the Fatah party. Israel has mobilized security forces to search for the prisoners, who they believe might try to reach the nearby West Bank. The Fatah movement has already hailed the prisoners' move, calling it a slap in the face of the Israeli regime and its military. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has also called it a heroic act and a great defiance against Israel's security system. That's all the time we have for this edition of World News. So bye-bye for now.
Diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Military contractor CACI International noted repeatedly that U.S. withdrawal from the 20-year Afghanistan war harmed the company's profits. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Sarah Lazar Ryder. This article is published under the heading Military Contractor CACI says Afghanistan withdrawal is hurting its profits. It's funding a pro-war think tank. Stay tuned for more. On August 12th, the military contractor CACI International Corporation told its investors that the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan is hurting its profits. The same contractor is also funding a think tank that is concurrently arguing against the withdrawal. This case is worth examining both because it is routine and because it highlights the venality of expert military contractor feedback loop in which private companies use think tanks to rally support for wars they will profit from. The contractor is notorious to those who have followed the scandal of U.S.-led torture in Iraq. CACI International was sued by three Iraqis formerly detained in Abu Ghraib prison who charged that the company's employees are responsible for directing their torture, including sexual abuse and electric shocks. The suit was brought in 2008 and the case is still ongoing. In 2019, CACI International was awarded a nearly $907 million five-year contract to provide intelligence operations and analytic support for the U.S. Army in Afghanistan. During an August 12th earnings call, CACI International noted repeatedly that U.S. withdrawal from the 20-year Afghanistan war harmed the company's profits. John Mengucci, president and CEO of CACI International, said, "We have about a 2% headwind coming into FY 2022 because of Afghanistan. A headwind refers to negative impacts on profits." Afghanistan was mentioned 16 times throughout the call, either in reference to the dent in profits or to assure investors that other areas of growth were offsetting the losses. For example, Mengucci said, "We are seeing positive growth in technology and expect it to continue to outpace expertise growth, collectively offsetting the impact of Afghanistan drawdown." Similar themes were repeated in an April 22nd earnings call, where the company lamented the headwinds posed by the Afghanistan withdrawal. Industry and defense publications have picked up on this theme, but framed it in the company's terms by emphasizing the offsets to its losses. Despite CACI International's clear economic interest in continuing the war, on August 12th call, company officials were careful not to editorialize about the Biden administration's decision. The closest they came was a cautious statement from Mengucci. "At least as of today, we have watched the administration make the decision to completely exit Afghanistan by 9/11, and all I can say is they are executing on that decision," unquote. But CACI International does not have to broadcast its positions on the war. Instead, it is funding a think tank that has been actively urging the administration not to leave Afghanistan. CACI International is listed as a corporate sponsor of the Institute for the Study of War, which describes itself as a nonpartisan, nonprofit public policy research organization. Dr. Warren Phillips, lead director of CACI International, is on the board of the think tank. Other funders include General Dynamics and Microsoft. When it comes to the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan, however, the think tank is extremely partisan. Jack Kinn, a retired four-star general and board member of the Institute for Study of War, meanwhile, has been on a cable news blitz arguing against the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan, as reported by Ryan Grimm, Sarah Sirota, Lee Fang, and Rose Adams for The Intercept. The Intercept noted CACI's international backing of the think tank. Kimberly Kagan, founder and president of the Institute for the Study of War, told Fox News on August 17th that the U.S. withdrawal could cause Afghanistan to become the second school of jihadism. She warned, "It is not clear that the Taliban, which seeks international recognition and legitimacy, is going to want to tolerate or encourage direct attacks on the U.S. from Al-Qaeda or other groups based in Afghanistan." The think tank's backing from a military contractor was not discussed in these media appearances. The case of CACI International is not unique. The Intercept notes, among other talking heads who took to cable news segments or op-ed pages without disclosing their defense industry ties, were retired General David Petraeus, Rebecca Grant, a former staffer for the Air Force Secretary, Richard Haass, who worked as an advisor to then Secretary of State Colin Powell, and former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice. This cacophony of voices matters because Biden is facing a media uproar over the withdrawal. Pundits and mainstream press outlets that have been ignoring civilian death for years are suddenly expressing moral outrage at their hardships now that the war is ending. While there are legitimate concerns about the fate of Afghans as the Taliban seizes control, the vast majority of the firestorm stems from a reflexively pro-war perspective in favor of the indefinite extension of an occupation that has proven brutal and lethal for civilians. The overwhelming effect is to send the message to the administration and any future presidents that they should think twice before completely withdrawing from a war, lest they have a media revolt on their hands. But this outcry didn't materialize out of nowhere. Think tank experts, whose organizations are financed by the very companies profiting from the war, play a key part. They're trotted out in front of cameras and quoted in major media outlets, presented as above-the-fray observers. They're well-financed, polished, and groomed precisely for moments like these. And the companies financing them get to launder their own objectives through institutions that are seen as respectable, academic, and rigorous. It's a grotesque system that is functioning as it was designed. In its August 12th call, CACI International simply acknowledged the company's economic interests out loud.
First methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we invite you to listen to a speech by Sheikh Hamza Sodagin.
Who is fighting Imam al-Hussein? Who is at war with Imam al-Hujjah? I don't want to go over concepts that are not practical, because that doesn't tell us what we're signing up for. That is, again, going to be something that's at least not clear. We want to be very practical, very contemporary. Anyone who takes any measure against Islam is fighting the manifestation of Islam, Imam al-Hujjah and Imam al-Husayn. Anyone who fights Islam, anyone who takes any measure against Islam, Amir al-Mu'mineen considered anyone who fought the Muslims, who was trying to create, impose a threat for the Muslimin from the outside, the Persian Empire, the Roman Empire, these were the ones that were there. Amir al-Mu'mineen considered them the enemies of Islam. Therefore, them creating and posing a threat for Muslimin. Ali ibn Abi Talib is in Medina. Ali ibn Abi Talib instructs people, including the second Khalifa, who was the accepted ruler at the time. Tells them, this is how you need to do it. Anyone who attacks Muslimin. Okay. Let's look at this, brothers and sisters. Let's look at the conditions that we have. Let's look at the Muslimin. Let's look at Islam. Western rulers have been fighting, besides others, Islam and the Muslimin for, in the recent history, the time that they started making progress and conquest of Muslim lands. In the last 150, close to 200 years, started going towards Muslim lands. They've been fighting. The British have fought the Muslimin, are fighting the Muslimin. The Portuguese fought Islam and the Muslimin. The Dutch fought Islam and the Muslimin. The French fought Islam and the Muslimin. The Germans did that. Any European power today, all these countries, the ones that are powerful, they have all been fighting Islam at a time where the U.S. was just developing. And then post-Second World War, again, amongst others, the United States government has been fighting Islam and Muslims on various different levels. Part of it is military combat, military conflict with Muslimin. We may disagree with Muslimin on certain levels and certain beliefs or whatever. But as the Prophet said, anyone from the outside of the Muslimin that attacks any Muslim and calls Ya lal Muslimin, it is the responsibility of the others to respond. And in other words, the one who is involved with aggression with Muslimin of whatever sect and whatever belief, they are fighting Islam and they are fighting Imam al-Hujjah. There's been numerous, they conquered all Muslim lands. Let's not forget that. From the Far East, the Philippines were Muslim lands. Malaysia, Indonesia, Muslim lands. India, Muslim lands. Bangladesh, Muslim lands. Much of that area is Muslim lands. They conquered all of that. Afghanistan, Central Asia, Uzbek, all these different lands, one way or another, whether the Eastern Europeans, Western Europeans, Iran, Iraq, Arabia, Northern Africa, various African countries, East Africa with such a large Muslim population, all conquered. There's war. That is, these are those who are harb with Islam and they are harb with the Imam of our time. When you say, إِنِّي حَرْبُ لِمَنْ حَرَبَكُمْ, you're saying, I'm at war with these people. Is this something of the past? Only military conflict. Western powers have been depicting, giving the image that reflects their image,
they're giving that to Islam. All the deaths that they have created in the past couple of centuries, the slavery that they have created, every wrong thing that they know and they reflect and is their image, they're saying Islam is that. This is a type of war.
The reason why an average Westerner would feel bad about seeing a Muslim, seeing a hijabi, an ignorant American would even go so far as using foul language, physically harassing a Muslimah. They're ignorant. The ones who are causing this ignorant person to think that way are the elite in the West. They've been fighting Islam in that way. Economic wars, ideological war, which is the essence of political war. This is who they are. This is what Harb al-Liman Harb. These are the ones that are doing Harb of the Imam of our time. If you want to sign up for Anis al-Liman Salam, if you want to say that in Ziyarat Ashura, you're referring to Abu Abdullah. You address him. You got to see him before you. Ya Abu Abdullah, inni silmun liman salamakum wa harbun liman harabakum. Harbun liman harabakum means these people who are fighting Islam, I am going to fight back.
If you don't want to, don't sign up for it. Don't say that. From the beginning, don't say it. Don't say, yeah, I do my...
These clothes, this amama is for the battlefield, the ideological battlefield. And it's our kefen. That's what it is. It's prepared. Any point.
This is what we sign up for. We sin when we say it. We ask Imam al-Hussein, if at any point, Ya Abu Abdullah, at any point, it gets to a point where you see, I may abandon you, abandon my post, not fight your enemies, abandon you in that battlefield. Ya Abu Abdullah, take this life. It's not worth living. If it's for Abu Abdullah al-Hussein, if it's for Imam al-Hujjah, alhamdulillah, ahla min al-asal. It's the best thing. I don't want this. We don't want this. These are the words of anyone who signs up for inni silmun liman salamakum wa harbun liman harabakum. If any European country decides to tell the Muslimin in that country, you are not allowed to show loyalty to Abu Abdullah al-Hussein by not being able to support the ones who put their lives down for Imam al-Hussein, who shed their blood for Imam al-Hussein, who were killed by the enemies of the Imam in Baghdad, Shahid Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis and Shahid Haj Qasim Sulaiman. If any European country decides to put that law, that's fighting Islam, that's harb against Islam. You are saying, harbul liman harabakum, I will fight back.
Ya Hussein, ya Habib, ya Hussein, ya Habib, ya Hussein, ya Habib, ya Hussein.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio.
Thank you.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
The limelight.
On numerous occasions, the press reported on Canadian troops killing Afghan civilians. Canadian soldiers have repeatedly killed and wounded civilians while on patrol in civilian areas, noted the New York Times in May 2007. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Yves Engler Ryder. This article is published under the heading Canada's Disaster in Afghanistan. Stay tuned for more. What a waste of human life and resources. More than 200,000 Afghan civilians and combatants have been killed since the U.S., Canadian, and British invasion 2 decades ago. A few thousand Canadian, U.S., British, etc. troops also died in the fighting. Canada's biggest military deployment since the Second World War, more than 40,000 Canadian troops fought in Afghanistan between 2001 and 2014. Canada spent $20 billion on the military operations and related aid mission in Afghanistan. While the stated rationale of the war was to neutralize al-Qaeda members and topple the Taliban regime, the Taliban has now regained control of the country. In October 2001, the United States unilaterally invaded Afghanistan, launching airstrikes. Canada's JTF-2 Special Forces aided these efforts. Individuals responsible for massive human rights violations during Afghanistan's mid-1990s war were appointed to prominent government positions. Some in the Canadian Forces CF sympathized with the Afghan warlords. In March 2006, Maclean's reported on General Rick Hillier's enormous respect for the warlords, even making allowances for those who profit from the puppy business. At the peak, over 3,000 Canadians fought a violent counterinsurgency in Kandahar. Between April 2006 and December 2007, Canadian troops fired an astounding 4.7 million bullets, including over 1,650 tank shells and 12,000 artillery rounds. In a line in the sand, Canadians at war in Kandahar, Captain Ray Wiss praised Canadian troops as the best at killing people. "We are killing a lot more of them than they are of us, and we have been extraordinarily successful recently. For the past week, we have managed to kill between 10 and 20 Taliban every day," unquote. In September 2006, the CF spearheaded NATO's Operation Medusa, aimed at Taliban strongholds in Punjabi and Zahari districts of Kandahar. This is how Corporal Ryan Pagnacco described the airstrikes. After watching bomb after bomb drop on these targets, I wondered how anything could survive. I figured that when we went in, we would be walking into a ghost town, unquote. The Medusa offensive forced 80,000 civilians to flee their homes, resulted in hundreds of enemy combatant deaths, and at least 50 civilians were killed over several weeks of bombing. On numerous occasions, the press reported on Canadian troops killing Afghan civilians. Canadian soldiers have repeatedly killed and wounded civilians while on patrol in civilian areas, noted the New York Times in May 2007. In July 2008, Canadian soldiers killed a 5-year-old girl and her 2-year-old brother after their vehicle got too close to a convoy. Canadian armored vehicles regularly fired warning shots at bikes, cars, or trucks that got too close, often causing crashes, leaving Afghans injured or worse. In June 2006, France 2 TV showed unedited images of Canadian troops searching villages and houses, breaking down doors, and interrogating residents. According to a report in La Presse, Canadian troops were shown telling villagers that it was not smart to join the Taliban because our troops are really good. They are well trained and good shots, and you will die. Later, the video shows a Canadian commander saying, "Too bad for you if you don't want to tell us where the Taliban are hiding. We will come and kill them. We will drop many bombs and fire all over. Is this what you want? Well then, continue telling us nothing," unquote. Canadian troops' actions in Afghanistan belie claims of high-minded motives. The CAF used white phosphorus as a weapon against enemy-occupied lands in Afghanistan, while Canadian Special Forces participated in highly unpopular nighttime assassination raids. The most deadly element of the war was airstrikes. While no Canadian planes dropped bombs in Afghanistan, Canadian troops regularly called in U.S. airstrikes. Canadian personnel also operated NORAD systems that supported U.S. bombings, and some heavily armed Canadian helicopters launched nighttime operations. Most of the individuals detained by Canadians and turned over to the Afghan army and prison system were likely tortured. Under the Geneva Conventions, the military force that detains someone is responsible for their treatment, and many of those detained by the CF were likely tortured with knives, power cables, and open flames. The second highest ranked member of Canada's diplomatic service in Afghanistan from 2006 to 2007, Richard Colvin, reported to a parliamentary committee that the likelihood is that all the Afghans we handed over were tortured. Additionally, dozens of individuals given to the Afghan army by the CF were unaccounted for, perhaps lost in a prison system that did not keep good records or maybe killed. Many of those detained by the CF had little to do with the Taliban. According to Colvin, it was the NDS, or Afghan National Directorate of Security, that told us that many or most of our detainees were unconnected to the insurgency. We detained and handed over for severe torture a lot of innocent people, unquote. The CF regularly handed over children they suspected of Taliban ties to the NDS, which often tortured them. The Toronto Star reported that in late 2006, a Canadian soldier heard an Afghan soldier raping a young boy and later saw the boy's lower intestines falling out of his body. Reportedly, the Canadian military police were told by their commanders not to interfere when Afghan troops and police sexually abused children. Thank you. Despite attempts to portray the situation otherwise, the invasion of Afghanistan did not have UN approval. After the United States invaded, the Security Council was pressured to authorize the use of force to defend the installed Afghan government. Non-American foreign troops in Afghanistan were effectively under U.S. command. Canada followed the United States into this 20-year-long predictable disaster. Every thoughtful person should learn a few lessons. Interference in other countries' internal affairs, whether civil war, as in the case of Afghanistan, or elections, is wrong. War is not good for those who profit from it. Do not trust those who beat the drums for war. They are likely paid directly or indirectly by the military-industrial complex. You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Imam Hussein and his followers endured agonizing pain and suffering during Ashura, November 21st, 2012. The pain and suffering which Imam Hussein and his followers endured on the day of Ashura were too agonizing, and the harm which was inflicted was very serious. The life of Hussein ibn Ali is more valuable than everything in the world. The pure and sacred lives of those followers of Imam Hussein, the lives of those youth and those members of Imam Hussein's household are not comparable to the life of other people. Their bodies were covered in blood and dirt. They made sacrifices and they laid down their lives. The households of the Holy Prophet and Imam Ali were imprisoned. Those events are very tragic and very difficult to tolerate. But what was achieved on the day of Ashura was so great and glorious that it made it easy for Imam Hussein and his followers and his household to endure the sufferings. This has been narrated by prominent figures. Imam Hussein sustained the path of the Holy Prophet, November 21st, 2012. The Islamic Ummah should never forget the event of Ashura, which is a lesson and a source of guidance for us. Definitely, Islam is alive because of the event of Ashura and the efforts of Hussein ibn Ali. And I am from Hussein. This narration means that Hussein continued the path of the Holy Prophet, and he continued to promote Islam after him. If it had not been for the event of Ashura, and if these great sacrifices had not been made in the history of Islam, this valuable experience and this practical lesson would not have been bestowed on the Islamic Ummah, and Islam would have definitely deviated from its path, as many religions before Islam did. And nothing would have remained from it. The greatness of Ashura is because of this.
Ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum Hussein, ana latsham.
Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, made the army of reason overcome the army of ignorance.
The greatness of Zainab al-Kubra's movement is reflected in her sermon at Kufa's Marketplace, April 21st, 2010. The greatness of Zainab al-Kubra's movement is reflected in what is left of her sermons. Her unforgettable sermon in Kufa's Marketplace was not just an ordinary speech. It was not just the personal opinion of an important figure. Her sermon was a great and beautifully worded analysis of the Islamic community's situation at that time. The sermon included the most profound Islamic concepts. See how strong her character was. Her brother and her imam and leader had been martyred in a desert just 2 days before. Her dear ones, her children, and many other people had been martyred. She and tens of other women and children were taken captive on the same day. They were paraded in different places. Some of the people who were watching them were cheerful and some were shedding tears. Zainab suddenly started her great mission in that critical situation.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding.